The following podcast is sponsored by SuperheroStuff.com.
Hello, folks. My name is Timothy Harvey, and I'm sitting across the bunker from Mr. Jason Hunt.
Shh, don't tell anyone I'm here.
This is apparently going to be a very odd conversation because I'm the only one here.
I'm hiding. Okay. I'm hiding from my age.
I have news. Your age has found you.
Oh, I know. It's latched onto me and it won't let go.
Just sucking the life out of you 1 second at a time.
I know. Hi. Hello. So what's your week been like?
Well, it's Monday when we're recording this. So my week has just begun. And so far it's Monday.
One of those.
Well, before we were recording here, I was detailing my woes to Jason here about a little film thing I'm trying to put together, and it's just fighting me as I, you know, it works fine on the timeline, and then try and export it, and it just does weird things. It's like, what is wrong with this? It's like, I've done this before. I'm actually good at this, and it's been very frustrating.
Yeah, I got a text earlier. I got a text from somebody, and went to go respond, and it wouldn't go. Maybe it's a signal thing. So I tried, you know, move the phone and try again. No, it wouldn't
sure.
go. Try again, wouldn't go. Try again, wouldn't go. Kept doing this for a good 15-20 minutes. I tried to send a text to you to test, see whether it was just, you know, everybody or what, and I couldn't send a text out. I could receive them, but I couldn't send them.
Right.
I got so frustrated because I'm trying to send a text and trying to take care of some things, and I can't send a note out, and nor could I get in contact with Sprint about the problem because Sprint's website doesn't have any kind of report a problem link.
Oh, really?
Technology. We loves it.
Well, it has its uses.
I suppose.
We are talking to people and doing this very thing on technology.
Yes, that is true. And those of you who would like to join the conversation, feel free to send us an email, h20@scififorme.com, or you can hit us up on the social media, or leave us a comment on our regular site, or you can call our hotline, which is 573-42-SCIFI. I'm going to try to get in the habit of saying some of that up front in the beginning of the shows, just so you guys have that information, and then we'll repeat it again toward the end, because we would like to engage more with our readers, with our listeners, with our audience. So feel free to pipe up and give us your two cents on anything that we talk about, except the Hugos.
No.
We're done talking about the Hugos, at least for what, a year? 6 months.
Yeah, well, at least for a little while, yeah.
Yeah. So, anyway, it was just completely changing direction this week from last week.
Right.
We got this came across my Facebook feed from the guys over at Axanar, Star Trek Axanar.
Sure.
Which actually has, for the most part, dropped the Star Trek from the title and all of the promotional stuff that they're doing. In essence, separating themselves from the intellectual property that is Star Trek. Because apparently there was a discussion with CBS at one point. Now, the Wrap has an article basically saying Axanar's this is dated August 25th. Beatrice Verhoeven is the author. A group of fans has crowdsourced the seven-figure Star Trek Axanar, and rights holders CBS and Paramount are doing nothing to stop it. Well, one, right there, there's a mistake. Because when you're doing a Star Trek series, mm-hmm. or anything based on Star Trek,
sure.
you're going to be talking to CBS, not Paramount.
Right.
Okay, so there's one error. The original Star Trek franchise has inspired countless fan-made films over its nearly 50 years, but a new amateur production in the works titled Star Trek Axanar represents a warp drive leap from its predecessors. The movie has raised $1.13 million in crowdfunding so far, making it one of the highest-financed fan films ever made. Originally seeking just $100,000 from a Kickstarter campaign, Axanar's producers eventually generated nearly seven times that, raising more than $638,000. And on Indiegogo, the crew made 189% of their target sum. They've since budgeted the feature film, which will be broken into four installments, a total of $960,000, $240,000 an episode. Could you imagine what we could do with $240,000?
Yeah, not just an episode, just in general.
Really. The seven-figure bankroll raises questions about just how fan the project is and at what point it poses a threat to the authorized franchise.
Mm.
There's something we'll circle back to. Executive producer Alec Peters told The Wrap. He says it's not a traditional fan film and doesn't have those limitations with it. Axanar's relatively sizable budget... although we fall under the fan movie, we've tried to make the product as good as coming out of the studio. The official line from CBS and Paramount, which manage the TV and film rights to the Star Trek franchise, respectively, is not to endorse such a production. Representative from the network, CBS has not authorized, sanctioned, or licensed this project in any way, and this has been communicated to those involved. We continue to object to professional commercial ventures trading off our property rights and are considering further options to protect these rights. Peter said that he and his team met with CBS last week, but the network didn't offer any specific guidelines concerning what his crew can and cannot do. The network simply told him they can't make money off the project. And then it goes on talking about the project and fan films in general and all of these things. Now, over at the Axanar website, mm-hmm. Alec Peters has a statement regarding this article and the fact that all of these people, all of these websites like ours, I mean, we haven't posted anything about it because this just came across.
Right.
He says, a lot of websites have been copying and pasting to create articles based on the piece which ran in The Wrap last week. None of these websites, such as CinemaBlend, have bothered to actually contact me. However, instead, they just expound on why CBS could be coming after Axanar. None of the articles are based on any facts, but are just stirring the pot because, let's face it, manufacturing drama is always a better story than discussing the truth, how a small group of fans are trying to change the way movies are made. He says he did meet with CBS at the Las Vegas Star Trek convention. Mm-hmm. So the meeting was with two of the top people in CBS. They were very frank about Axanar. And while I can't talk about most of what we discussed over the 30 minutes we chatted, I can tell you a few things. They told us everyone at CBS and Paramount was aware of Axanar. They told us that we are certainly doing more than any fan film before, and that has some people concerned. We also discussed that CBS will not tell us what we either can or cannot do for legal reasons. We can talk about that a little bit more. They are very clear that they do not want to give guidance because it could negatively impact their IP rights.
Sure.
Okay, so we have Star Trek Axanar, which is a huge, ambitious project.
Oh, yeah.
And it does involve some people that have been involved in official productions, Star Trek productions.
Sure.
And then you got Star Trek Renegades, which just dropped on YouTube. Mm-hmm. We posted a review from Angie Sutton, who was a little disappointed in it, that it wasn't more than what it was, given the fact that so many Star Trek alumni are part of this thing.
Right.
And she's like, well, it's a fan film. It's an obvious fan film. And then, of course, you got Phase 2, which I think has gone back to the New Voyages moniker. They were the first
right.
ones to really get on the map. And then you've got Star Trek Continues, mm-hmm. which has Jimmy Doohan's son playing Scotty.
Right.
And doing a fantastic job of it.
No surprise there.
And then, of course, you've got Star Wars fan films, and you've got DC Comics fan films. What else is out there? Twentieth Century Fox just shut down an Alien fan film here not too long ago.
Oh, we've got Alien fan films. You got Mortal Kombat. You've got
Power Rangers.
Star Wars. I mean, you pretty much got everything. DC, Marvel.
Yeah.
You don't see a lot of Image.
Or Stargate.
I haven't seen
too many of them. You've seen Stargate?
No, I was actually. I'm trying to think if I have. I've ever seen a Stargate fan film. I don't think I have.
Doctor Who, of course.
Oh yeah, Doctor Who fan films, especially in periods where there has been no new content.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of been the fan model, is to generate new content of their own. Because the official people are not putting any out.
No.
Or they're putting out stuff that you don't like.
and back in the day, it was fanzines that were doing a lot of this stuff.
Oh, sure,
you know,
of course.
You didn't have the money to make movies. You just told, you know, you wrote your own short stories and sent them to your friends and so them ended up
being published in by reputable publishing companies. There are a few of the early Star Trek original Star Trek novels, which are clearly fan fiction. Just reading them going, no, just stop.
Which one are you talking about?
Oh, God, Spock Must Die.
I actually thought Spock Must Die is not bad, because that's James Blish.
Well, I know, but I wasn't impressed. I just felt a little, it felt very, especially looking at a lot of Blish's stuff, it felt very, but some things like, oh, for heaven's sakes.
Vulcan by Kathleen Sky.
Oh, that's one.
Yeah.
There were the ones that were the vaguely... They were pretty much just a few steps away from being softcore. A lot of torture and... Oh, for heaven's sakes, what's the name of that author?
Are you talking about The Price of the Phoenix?
Yes.
The Fate of the Phoenix?
Oh, God.
Sandra Marshak and Myrna Culbreth. Marshak.
Yeah, you know what? To each their own. well, you know, and they are far from the first to take Kirk and Spock in interesting places. And I've actually read some of their stuff that I've liked. But it just was very much, to me, it felt a little too much like, you know, thinly veiled desires.
Right.
And, again, not the first person to put the two leads. I believe that might have been 1800s and Holmes and Watson, if not earlier. well, actually, no, it was probably Gilgamesh and Enkidu. So somebody was probably, you know, knocking that out on a tablet. And I don't mean the ones you get from the computer store. I mean, like, ding, ding, ding.
Back in the day.
So it's the same, you know. There's a rich history of this.
Oh yeah, fan fiction has been around for a long time.
Well, and I think in some respects, if you really want to go all the way back, I'm pretty sure you could argue that the storytelling ape, we do a pretty good job of. I mean, we kind of do that. Everything becomes fan fiction. I think a lot of Arthur's legends, you could argue, were fan fiction. In the purest sense, because you'd have the bards go out there and they'd be retelling the tales and they'd start coming up with their own. It's like, wouldn't it be cool? Wouldn't it be cool if Arthur and Lancelot found the Grail and did this? You know, I'm going to tell that story at the next campfire. when it comes to these licensed properties, to these big things, you get into the wilderness years of any of this stuff. And of course, Star Trek had its wilderness years and Star Wars had its wilderness years, Doctor Who. Or shows that have been canceled. You know, I guarantee you that if you type in Firefly fan fiction, you'll find it all.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, there's a ton of it.
So it's we don't want the stories to end. And especially when you become emotionally attached to some of these characters, the way that we, I think you could argue very strongly that, you know, we're all attached to Kirk and Spock and McCoy and Luke and Leia and Han and, you know, Mal and Jane and Inara. I mean, you're not gonna want those stories to end. So if the people who made them aren't gonna keep making them, well, by God, I'll do it myself.
Yeah. You know? Well, and you even have people, you know, like I said, with Star Trek, I think it's kind of a unique thing because you have so many people that were actually involved in Star Trek for real.
Mm-hmm.
Now participating. I mean, George Takei and Walter Koenig have both showed up on New Voyages, as well as William Wyndham and Barbara Luna.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got Michael, I can't remember his name, played Apollo, reprised his role on Continues,
mm-hmm.
playing Apollo again.
Sure.
You have Grant Imara, who's not from Star Trek, but he's on... Or he was on Mythbusters.
Right.
You know, he's got a little bit of geek cred, I guess you could say.
Sure.
Lou Ferrigno showed up on one of these once.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's one of those things where now you're starting to get a lot more serious participation on the part of the creative types.
You know, right.
Not just on the on-screen part of it, but behind the scenes too, you've got people that are, you know, like Dennis Dockerman, you know, all, directors of photography, and you know, people like David Gerald and those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
It's starting to become a serious thing, and I wonder at what point how far it can go before the studios and the license owners have to pay attention to it. Because right now, they turn a blind eye.
Well,
because,
no, you know, I guarantee you they're paying attention to it.
I mean, in an official capacity. Okay, we've gone too far. Now this has to stop. And
well,
at some point...
I think if any of these people start making money on the deal, if they, you know, that kind of has been the bright, you know, red line that nobody can cross, is that if you turn a profit on our property.
Yeah, but how do you measure something like that? I mean, if you've got a fan film that has a budget and you start to pay people,
well,
then you have,
but
I mean,
you're not,
for
you're
all
not
intents and purposes,
yeah,
you're, but you're still,
you're,
I mean,
paying people.
Okay.
Well, no, but you're not.
I mean,
paying, you
it's
know.
it's a slight distinction, but
oh no! For those that kind of thing, it's a very distinct distinction, because you're looking at, if I give, you know, if the people who are producing the film spend all the money that they make on making the film,
mm-hmm.
and they make no money on the film, then you're not making a profit. Studios can tell you all day long how the film that made $250 million. Lost money.
Right.
So it's kind of a variation on that, I think, which is, you know, well, you had $90,000 and you spent it all. Did you make any money? No. Okay. We're not going to sue you into a tiny pulp.
Because that's
what would happen. If you're making the money off somebody else's property, they're going to...
What I wonder about is... You know, things like, the Power Rangers, I guess, would be the most recent example of a fan film that, according to some, including the license owner, it went too far, and in terms of the violence and the gore, and being so far removed from what the real. Mm-hmm. version is that it creates a problem.
And well, sure, because
Saban had to go, went after him. They had some sort of an agreement that they hammered out.
Right.
And Marvel has done this before with Chris Notaril, on one of his Deadpool films.
Right.
They went out, they hit him with a cease and desist on that particular one.
Sure. Well, if you are painting someone's property in a negative light, or what can be perceived in a negative light, and remember that Power Rangers, of course, is something that is aimed at children.
Mm-hmm.
It is not a grown-up series. It is not. Grown-ups may enjoy it, but it's firmly aimed at younger audiences.
Right.
So if you take something like the Power Rangers film, which was certainly very interesting, and I thought, it was a unique and rather unexpected in the context. If you're familiar with the Power Rangers at all, you're not looking at it going, "Wouldn't this be great as a gritty drama?" You don't think that. So the fact that you pushing it in that direction, painting those characters in that way, can have a negative impact on, can be perceived as having a negative impact on someone's intellectual property. So yeah, they go after you. But at the same time, there is that, some of these folks are keenly aware of parody law, the parody guidelines and things like that. If you can, you can poke fun at something and you can make a parody version of something.
Right.
Up to a point without, for example, extreme example, the porn industry has been making parody superhero movies. There's a Doctor Who.
There's one for everybody.
I know. So yeah. I know, but there's just like, don't stop. But it's, and they, the costumes.
Mm-hmm.
The costumes are scary good.
Yeah,
they're dumping a ton of money into these things, and making there's a Batman 66 one.
Is there?
Oh God! Oh yeah.
I would imagine there's probably something for every.
Sure. Thing. There's for every kink out there. If you're into superheroes, guess what, folks? You got to hit the internet.
Yeah.
There's.
But a fan film is not a parody.
Well, and that becomes the real question, is where does the line for some of these drawn? Because a fan film could be a parody and could fall under...
Well, some could. I mean, you look at something like Inspector Spacetime,
mm-hmm.
which is obviously a riff on Doctor Who, mm-hmm. but it's done in a way that makes the whole thing really cheeky and silly and whatever. So that's a parody. That would be something...
But you could also look at something like the BBC... is keenly aware there's been a lot of fan Doctor Who everything.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly in the years where the show was off the air, there was that whole period of time where they didn't even, they licensed off the license to Virgin Books for, 10 years, 15 years?
Something like that. Yeah.
They didn't even care. And it took them forever to sit there and go, oh, yeah. Maybe we should get the rights back to our own character. So for some of the, I think some of these cases, the studios appreciate the fans keeping it alive and keeping people interested.
Because it's marketing.
Yeah, and there's a symbiotic relationship that.
But then
that,
you look at something like you talk about superhero parodies and stuff, and then you look at something like what the Nerdist did with their DC Comics Christmas card videos,
mm-hmm.
and I started to watch one of those, and I got maybe 30 seconds, 45 seconds, a minute into it, and mm-hmm. the language was such that I just didn't want to see it.
Sure. Well, and you know,
and I'm like, how could DC be letting this? Because that's been the big thing. Especially with capes, is that Marvel and DC turns a blind eye, and we've been told,
mm-hmm.
Marvel at least, unofficially turns a blind eye to these things as long as you're presenting the characters in the right way.
Right.
And I look at what Nerdist did with the DC characters on those two videos, and... One, they're terribly done, from a craft standpoint. I mean, they're just utter drag. I don't know where they didn't put very much money into them.
Sure.
Two, the language in it is so foul, and the interplay between all of them is just raw and ugly at some points. You gotta wonder how did DC say okay? Because it's Nerdist. It's not somebody that's just making some little thing that's going on YouTube. This is Nerdist.
Sure. Well,
Industries.
Okay. So they basically, you know, I could see how it would go. Here's how the pitch goes. You sit there and say, "Hey, we're gonna do this. We think it'd be really, really funny if we took those characters and made them behave in this way."
Mm-hmm.
And it's a couple of things. We'll do a couple of them, and you know.
I mean, Saturday Night Live didn't even go that far.
Well, but Saturday Night Live couldn't go that far. You know, you look at
they could have gone farther than they went.
Well, sure, but now I think you're looking at a really curious balancing act. I think when you have films like The Avengers or Captain America or things like that, you've got such a big audience. There's only so much you can poke fun at them
mm-hmm.
on a network show without, you know, biting the hand that feeds you.
Right.
And that's good and bad. I think bad because, you know, from a creative standpoint, if you're doing a comedy show, you know, being told you can't tell that joke is always kind of a raw deal. But
right.
at the same time, it's also good because you do want to have a balance. You bear in mind that you have, you know, even shows like Saturday Night Live have children watching. And, you know, it is a network program. So there's a certain amount of, you know, there's a certain amount of agreement with your audience.
Yeah.
That this is what you're going to get. And, you know, some of the greatest train wrecks in SNL history have been when the guest host has failed to understand that.
Mm.
And, you know, the list of people who are never going to be allowed back on the Saturday Night Live set includes some very, very, very public meltdowns on camera. but yeah, I don't know. It's a very, very interesting distinction, I think, between what they'll let you get away with and what they won't. I mean, because remember, what was it, the one Batman versus Predator and Alien? Batman Dead End.
Yeah.
I think that was kind of the first real big fan film brouhaha that I remember.
Right.
And that was the most public, one of the earliest public ones, I guess.
Yeah, and I think really the press that I saw, and it was all of this, oh, look at this, this is fantastic. Mm-hmm. I mean, there wasn't, I don't remember seeing very much in the way of legal issues. I mean, I've watched the documentary about the making of, mm-hmm. and I know there was a little bit of back and forth in there somewhere, but you know, given that it was just a demo, it was, you know, Sandy Carolla was sitting there saying, I want to direct movies, and here's what I'm going to do to show you that I can direct.
Sure.
Of course, it backfired spectacularly on him because of his attitude about it afterwards, but he's even admitted, you know, that he's made some mistakes in the wake of the popularity of that film.
Oh, sure.
You know, that's had some impact on his career. But even then, you know, that, you're right, that one, it's not a parody.
No, no.
It's not any kind of making fun of. It's a serious effort at telling a story about Batman facing off against these two alien creatures.
Oh, sure. But it's a licensing nightmare.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. to put it mildly. And I'm actually surprised that nobody shut him down.
Well, and I think again, you run into something like when it comes to the Alien films or the Predator films, the very simple fact that you have... I mean, this was pre-Alien versus Predator.
Yeah.
This was pre the franchises crossing, aside from the little tip of the hat in Predator 2.
Well, and there were rumblings about, you know, fans were sitting there wanting to do that kind of thing, and there were some rumblings that eventually something like that might happen.
Oh, sure, but the cost, but the cost of something like that,
right?
You know, from a fan standpoint, I mean, making a good looking alien costume or a really good looking Predator costume that, yeah. that will hold up on film. I mean, it's one thing, and not to knock the amazing costumes you see at conventions, but there's a difference between something you just walk around in mm-hmm. and something you perform in.
Right.
And of course, you need to have, for a Predator versus Alien, you need to have a fight scene.
Oh,
which
sure.
means it's got to take some punishment.
And I've seen, we've seen some Predator costumes at Planet and Kansas City Comic Con that are really, really good.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't have any doubt they could hold up.
Yeah, but
I think they could.
But did you see when there was just an Alien costume out at KC Comic Con? Did you see that guy?
I didn't see that one.
Yeah, it was kind of terrible. Well, and you know, I mean, for a con, for something that to entertain people, it
right.
was okay. But I mean, in terms of it being a accurate
screen ready,
no, not even close.
Yeah.
And there, I think he was going actually around with a Predator guy who was really looked really right. good.
We had an idea even for this is where we had an idea for a Star Wars fan film
mm-hmm.
back. Oh, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 years ago. James and I had talked about a couple of things, and I had this idea that we could involve Tom,
mm-hmm.
Tom Kane, the voice of Yoda, since mm-hmm. we know him.
Right.
We talked about, you know, we'll put Tom in a supporting role mm-hmm. as a smuggler, and he could actually, you know, play a part as opposed
right.
to doing a
sure.
voice, and set some of the flashbacks in Bespin.
Mm-hmm.
So right before everything fell apart in Bespin, you know, Tom's character right. would be down below decks, and he would be there when the Empire arrived. So we would be able to have Darth Vader and the Stormtroopers walk down the hall.
Sort
of a
Tag and Bink are dead?
Yeah, you know, kind of, it's yeah. like one of those...
Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead?
Exactly.
Yeah,
yeah, it's just right. one of those things where it's, you know, it's an incidental piece.
Sure.
But you get to use your cosplayers that you know and
sure,
say, hey, can
right.
we have Darth Vader and Boba Fett and all these...
Right.
But at the same time, you sit there going, okay, we're going to put all of this effort into this, and what?
Right.
You know, because we don't make enough money doing our real jobs to spend all of this time and effort into a fan film that...
What's your end result? What do you
exactly.
gain? I think for some of these folks where they're actually using it as a proof of concept or, you know, showing off what they can do to the, you know, as a... Basically, as an audition
yeah.
for something. That's one thing. But you look at stuff like Star Trek Continues or The New Voyages or Axanar, any of that stuff. And that's not something where, I mean, it might be part of it. But at the same time, you just know that, you know, the folks who are doing Continues and that sort of thing are not, no one's going to come along and say, we're going to bring the original show back to television, and you're going to be the cast. That's not going
right.
to happen, and they know that. I mean, they're not having any illusions. They just want to tell new stories.
No, the question I have, if CBS does actually decide that they're going to bring Star Trek back to television at some point, do they have to then scrutinize the fan films a little bit more and say, okay, our stuff, official stuff, is going to be available online now. Your stuff has to go away.
Maybe. I think that you could run into the issue of wanting to clear the boards
mm-hmm.
for the official stuff. Or you could again look at it as it ends up being free advertising.
No.
Somebody else is out there doing your advertising for you.
Market.
And I think for Paramount, CBS, when you're looking at the Star Trek franchise, when was the last Star Trek film? But I mean, that gap in between the alternate timeline reboot and the last Next Generation movie.
Oh, I think it's been, what, 10 years?
Something like that. And that's a long time
yeah.
to let a franchise... Even a franchise that had disappointing numbers at the end, those films still made money.
Mm-hmm.
And just because you realize that you're continuing the franchise the way they're doing it right now is not going to be the best thing financially. You don't shoot yourself in the foot by or the head by saying, you know, we're never going to make another one of these.
Right.
So and so they reboot the series, and they recognize that the original cast is always going to be the most famous cast and favorite cast. And so they do their reboot thing, and it makes a bazillion dollars. Whether you like it or not, they're very profitable for Paramount.
Right.
So the fact that they didn't go after these folks who are doing, you know, the original series continues.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not to mention, way to really burn bridges with the fans.
Well, that's true.
I mean, yeah. You can really do yourself, you know, that's some PR damage right there. It's like, yeah, that's very nice. You made some very nice episodes and good job. And the sets look great. So we're going to shut you down and we're going to need you to destroy all this because,
we'd better go down to Oklahoma City and shoot our real quick
exactly.
then, right?
Exactly. Yeah. They're not going to do that. I mean, because it would be terrible PR.
Well, yeah, and I do think you're right too that it's free advertising for their stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of which, we need to take a break so you can hear about stuff.
Superhero stuff.
Superherostuff.com. They are a sponsor of this show, and we do appreciate their support. You should check them out for all of their licensed stuff. They do have Star Trek stuff.
They do have Star Trek and Star Wars and Doctor Who and
Godzilla.
And
Transformers.
Oh, yeah. And
DC Comics, Marvel Comics.
Some great mugs, by the way. You should always buy their mugs.
Yes, we've got several mugs now. So we're going to let you hear from them. And on the other side of the break, we're going to talk a little bit more about fan productions and a prediction from Rod Roddenberry when H2O continues.
You're listening to H2O on Sci-Fi for Me Radio.
Can you get Age of Ultron stuff?
Superherostuff.com.
Where can you get Justice League stuff?
Superherostuff.com.
Where can you get Doctor Who stuff?
Superherostuff.com.
Where can you get Daredevil stuff?
Superherostuff.com.
New items being added all the time. Get your superhero stuff at superherostuff.com. Plus, the Hero Box is back. $70 worth of superhero stuff for only $49. Superherostuff.com, where heroes shop.
Atomic Cotton, where Erica and Zach combine their passion for art and film to create wearable art. All original, made with a love for the genre. Coming to a convention near you very soon. Or find them on the web at atomiccotton.com. Atomic Cotton, shirts and art for fans by fans.
Hi, this is Jason Hunt, and if you're one of the dedicated listeners for this show, first of all, thank you. Second, you are sharing with others, are you not? And you should be aware by now, we have many shows as part of Sci-Fi for Me Radio. Our Marvel discussion on Level 117, the DC chat on the Rogues Gallery, Sci-Fi for Chicks talking about various topics, which we also do in mixed company on the Echo Chamber, and H2O, which is our one-on-one discussion between Mr. Harvey and myself, now syndicated over at Amazing Stories Magazine. Sci-Fi for Me Radio is more than one show, and we'd like to invite you to join us for all of it, or at least try it out and see what you think. And also check out Sci-Fi for Me TV. That's our YouTube channel where we have interviews, convention panel video, and Week in Review, where we deliver a digest of the news of the week. All part of giving you the most bang for your buck. Oh yeah, wait, no, it's free. So check it out. Sci-Fi for Me Radio and Sci-Fi for Me TV. All part of SciFiForMe.com, your portal to the science fiction multiverse.
Sci-Fi for Me Radio. Stop your nagging and let's go explore.
Back on H2O, Jason Hunt here, along with Timothy Harvey.
Hello.
And we are talking about fan films, fan fiction. Oh, hey, that reminds me. Saw a thing. Oh, where was it? I think Kevin Dillmore or Dayton Ward, one of them, had posted. There was a link on Star Trek's website. Part of the 50th anniversary is going to include a return of the Strange New Worlds competition.
Yeah.
Which I'm excited about. James has already said, we're doing one, right? We're writing a story, right? Well, okay, if you want to. Sure, let's do that. So we're going to collaborate on a fan fiction story ourselves for the Strange New Worlds competition once we find out what the requirements are, because there hasn't been anything official yet. But that's out there, and you know, and that's another way that the license holders have embraced the fan fiction, you know, because Star Trek, Paramount, Pocket Books, all of those guys, they went for 10 books collecting fan fiction, in an official capacity. Mm-hmm. You know, it was one of those things, and it's not the first time they'd done it. Because if you look back in the, I think it was the late 70s, early 80s, mid 80s, where they had the New Voyages anthologies.
Right.
There were two of them. And mm-hmm. those were fan fiction collections as well. Yeah. That's mm-hmm. where Mindsifter came from.
Right.
Which was now an episode of New Voyages, Phase mm-hmm. 2.
Right.
New Voyages. Whatever they're calling it now. But it's interesting that you've got all of this potential, because the Strange New Voyages competitions, they actually produced people like Kevin and Dayton, mm-hmm. who were fans and wrote fan fiction, and now they're professionally doing Star Trek books as a result of that.
Sure.
So it's been one of those things where there's a proving ground in some of this, and you know, maybe you get somebody like a James Cawley or a Vic Mignogna, or, you know, somebody who sits there and says, okay, I'm going to make these fan films to get my practice in mm-hmm. so I can get good at XYZ, whatever skill, talent I need to get good at,
right,
to go and get work doing it. Mm-hmm. Because we had talked about when, you know, at one point we had talked about doing a Star Trek fan film, and I told James, I was like, well, why don't we do our own thing instead of doing a Star Trek story? Why don't we come up with a brand new universe, a brand new story universe?
Right.
And that's something we've been working on, kind of off on the back burner in the background. But it's those opportunities, those things where you turn something into something else, and Rod Roddenberry, who's the son of Gene Roddenberry, mm-hmm. he's been working on some different projects, and somebody was they were asking, you know, where is the genre going to be going? Where is it going to be in 15, 20, 50 years?
Right.
And he says, I don't think it's going to be on traditional TV networks. This is an interview he did with 1701 News. He says, I think the next great thing could come out of a fan's mind, self-developed by a talented, passionate young man or woman. Nowadays, almost anyone can get content out there, and with computer tech, people who can do amazing things. And you look at some of the visual effects on some of these fan films, they're just as good as anything you'd find on television now.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and we've got Bruce Brannett, who is here in Kansas City. How much has he actually done for real network shows? Lost and Fringe.
He's a go-to guy for a lot of this stuff. He's done a lot of network and movie stuff. And of course, we got Jim McCullough, who's an up-and-coming guy.
Yeah,
here in town.
For those of you who want to see some of Brannett's work, there are two things out there mm-hmm. right. that are really representative of Bruce's work. There's three things. World Builder is mm-hmm. one. 405
right,
is the other. 405 was the first one.
Right, and that got a lot of attention.
And it got copied, too. Did you see the Nissan commercial that copied it? And everybody went, Bruce, was that you? He went, no, but it should have been. I imagine there were some conversations had after that.
Oh, I'm sure.
But, 405, World Builder was the second one. And then he did a Star Wars. It's called Big Red Bow, mm-hmm. and it's a play on the whole, you know, the car showing up in the driveway with a big bow on it,
right.
commercials, and he was doing this to as I think it was an entry in a competition mm-hmm. for Star Wars theme parks, I think, or Disney Resorts or something. He was doing something as this, but the work on those three short films that he's done, far and above a lot of stuff that you'd see in full-length feature films.
Oh, yeah.
And it's kind of ironic, too, because his Star Trek or his Star Wars spot looked better than the prequels.
Well,
but that's just me.
Well, but Bruce's Bruce just really cares about what he does.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he's super talented,
and that's always a good thing. You know, there's nothing, no complaint we can have about that. But
no. I think if you took the really talented, passionate fans, and some of them are passionate, but they don't have talent. We have to acknowledge that. But if you take the really talented ones, you know, people like Bruce Brannett, people like Chris Doohan,
mm-hmm.
you know, those types, and put them all in a room together and see what they come up with. Just throw money at them and say, okay, you get one shot to do something official. Show us what you got. But it's never going to happen because you get people like Michael Dorn who have been pitching an official Star Trek Worf series for how many years now?
Oh, yeah.
And Brian Fuller, who's been trying to get something going, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Or it may have been Brian Singer at one point was trying to pitch something, too. There are all these people, recognizable names,
mm-hmm.
who say, I want to make a Star Trek series. And CBS goes, yeah, no. Not yeah. today. Check back next week.
Right. Well, yeah. You know,
I don't understand why Star Trek's not on TV yet. Because there's so much you can do with that universe.
I don't know why
that's not going to interfere with the movies.
I don't know why they didn't run with the animated version they were talking about doing. Remember that? Uh-huh. Remember that? It was set very far in the future. So you had another jump in tech. You had another jump in culture. You had a brand new, you know, the Federation. It was basically a new version because the universe had changed,
right.
as things will. And it was, I thought it was really, you know, I liked the design of it.
I think some of that ended up in the video game, didn't it?
You know, it might have.
Star Trek Online, I think, is where some of that ended up.
It probably did.
Maybe.
But it is kind of a strange thing because Star Trek is, in many ways, a license to print money.
Mm-hmm. It's like the Marvel Universe.
But at the same time, it is also, science fiction is expensive to make. There is a cost. And remember that when Next Generation came out, it was like the most expensive TV show ever produced.
Yeah, I think they were spending like $1 million per episode or
right.
something like
and
that.
And that was a good chunk of that was in special effects. And of course, paying off your sets. But, you know, there was the computer graphics were state of the art. And I mean, it was all very, very, very expensive.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, it can be done, but you look at something like, say, Dark Matter or Killjoys over on Sci-Fi Channel.
Mm-hmm.
Or, I'm sorry, Sci-Fi. No, I mean, we may actually have to call them the Sci-Fi Channel if they're going to keep this up. And you can tell that, so for example, Dark Matter. Gee, are those the sets from Stargate Universe redressed?
Dark Matter looks so much like a late 80s, early 90s series.
Both of them do.
The aesthetic on it, I have to wonder if that's on purpose. It has to be on purpose.
Both of them kind of are.
Because that's the era when the Sci-Fi Channel was at its height.
Mm, sure.
You know, that's back when they were doing Stargate, and you had Farscape, and you had, what were some of the other ones? Lex. Was on Sci-Fi mm-hmm. Channel, and you had all of these different things that were on there. It was right before Battlestar Galactica was their last one that really was the big hurrah.
Sure.
And, you know, shows like Mutant X and Hercules and mm-hmm. Xena and Andromeda and all of these, you know, Earth Final Conflict,
right.
all of these shows, Sliders, they were all in that same time period.
Sure.
In terms of when they were on the air.
Mm-hmm.
And you go back and you look. And they all have that same
90s aesthetic.
Visuals yeah. aesthetic that dates it,
mm-hmm.
but at the same time, it really kind of makes it timeless because it's of an era,
right?
And it sort of kind of holds up.
Sure. So, well, I think Killjoys manages to do that in a way that doesn't feel quite so rooted in that. I mean, they've actually. you could, it still evokes some of that, but at the same time, they've done some really smart production design decisions.
Mm-hmm.
They have found interesting locations to make it look like something that's not. Oh, look, it's a
Toronto.
Yeah,
Vancouver.
But at the same time, there's also some very curious ones. It's like, why does a space station have a room like this? Why does a spaceship have a hallway like this? These are things that no sensible designer of either of these things is going to go, this is where we're going to put the atrium. No, you're not.
Yeah.
But, you know, so it's of the two. Well, of course, Dark Matter is based on a comic book. Killjoys is not.
Right.
So it becomes a question of does that aesthetic inspire a kind of comfort zone for the viewer, or is it a turnoff? Because I think that for some folks it does, because it does have a certain look.
Yeah.
It could definitely be something like, oh, that looks kind of cheesy in 90s.
But then you go back and you look at, you know, fan films
mm-hmm.
that are based on those kind of shows, you know, just in general. And the line starts to blur a little bit in terms of what these shows look like, because mm-hmm. how many shows? Well, I guess Sanctuary was one of the first ones that really, really embraced the virtual set.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah,
and before that, I mean, the fan films were all over green screen. I mean, anything and everything was green screen on the fan films because they couldn't afford to build a set. They just made a picture and green screen
stuff. Terrible.
Yeah.
Terrible.
And some of the green screen work on Sanctuary, when it was a web series before it went to a full series on Sci-Fi, some of that was dodgy too.
Oh, sure. But I think you end up with the marketing potential for something like that, because, of course, you had the people who were involved.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Who come with cred.
Right.
And then you have, but not necessarily with a lot of money.
Right.
You know, we tend to forget that TV actors, while they may have a steady income, are very few, especially in the genre, because genres often gets the short end of the stick. They're not getting Friends, you know, paychecks. They're not getting Modern Family paychecks. They're not getting, you know, they're getting.
Yeah.
And in some respects, because it is to some degree a niche market. Comedy, you know, TV comedies are, everybody loves TV comedies. It's like, you know, that it's the wide open market. Science fiction shows and you know, are for science fiction fans.
Right.
You're not going to, you know, who happen to be comedy fans. So they're over there watching, you know, Friends or Seinfeld or whatever. And whatever,
but the Friends audience is not necessarily going to translate over into
Stargate. So, no. But still, you know, you've got these, you know, Amanda Tapping and company put together something that was entertaining, but they had a good story, you know. So,
I think that's the other thing that you have to look at is
you know, story.
when you look at New Voyages, or you look at, you know, well, because New Voyages was using scripts from the old Phase 2 TV mm-hmm. series,
sure.
That was in development for Star Trek mm-hmm. before it went to the movies. So they're actually using scripts that were written for the show, and, you know, people like David Gerrold or DC Fontana,
mm-hmm.
you know, people that wrote for the show are writing their scripts and directing right. their episodes, and it's mind blowing that they can get these people involved in a fan production.
Well, I think you know, everybody loves playing in that world. I mean, you know, Gerald and Fontana and everybody who's been involved, from the actors and, you know, they understand how important Star Trek was
yeah.
and how important it still is. I mean, you would not have the two J.J. Abrams films if there hadn't been an audience.
Oh, you wouldn't have Star Wars without Star Trek.
Oh yeah, of course. But I mean, you wouldn't, you know, if it had lost any of its grasp on the culture, we would never have had two expensive Star Trek movies.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, they made their money back and then some, and they were incredibly profitable. But you know, it's expensive to build big sets. It's expensive to do that kind of special effects.
Yeah.
And you know, the reason you do that is because there's an audience. And for all that, you know, people necessarily think of themselves, might not think of themselves as science fiction fans. Star Trek has a grasp on the culture. You know, it's an American, you know, it's in the American culture. I mean, there's an audience for it. Now, how much these fan productions, how much, you know, traction they're getting with the wider public is a good question.
Yeah, that would be the thing to look at. Well, and you know, stuff like Galaxy Quest,
mm-hmm.
which, if you look at it one way, sideways, it's sort of a fan parody of Star Trek. In a sense.
Oh, if you stare directly at it, it's a fan parody of Star Trek.
Well, yeah, but it's an official production. It's not necessarily something where, oh, you know, the people who
wrote it are fans.
Yeah. But, you know, it's considered the seventh best Star Trek film ever. Actually, it was actually voted on at a Star Trek convention in Las Vegas.
Yeah, no, it makes perfect sense.
The seventh best Star Trek movie is Galaxy Quest.
Sure, which is, you know,
which is going to television.
Yeah, you know, if it makes it past the pilot stage,
right? Which I think it will.
If they do,
that's going to be one of those tests, like you say. Is you know, at what point does the online offering or the fan film or whatever become popular enough that it's a viable thing? Because you can't, you know, like I said, fan films can't make any money.
Right.
You know, you can get money to make your stuff, but you've got to spend it all. Mm-hmm. You can't hold on to it. You can't bank it or do anything like that.
Right.
So it's kind of a win-win for the studios, but at the same time, how much further are we going to go with fan productions before the fan productions are just as good, if not better, than some of the official stuff that's out? And what happens at that point?
Well, okay, the only time when you're going to get that level of quality in small quantities, you're not going to be able to maintain a two-hour feature with the same level of effects work that you're going to get out of Paramount.
I don't know. I'm looking at Axanar, and everything, because that's going to be feature length.
Oh, I know. It looks really, really good, but they're also throwing a ridiculously large amount of money for this sort of thing at it.
Right.
Okay. Most people are not playing with that kind of money. Most people do not have anything remotely resembling that kind of money doing these things. So they're doing it themselves. They're doing it on their own computers. They happen to be really good CG, you know, artists themselves, or they've got, you know, really good actors and really good sets or whatever it is. But it's costing them the kind of money that you're not going to be able to do. You know, how much does it cost, you know, these continuations of the original series with these, you know, complete sets and reproductions of costumes? I mean,
yeah,
these are not cheap things to do. There's only going to be a select group of people who can actually afford it. And, you know, hey, all power to more people doing it.
Sure.
You know.
Well, and the guys at Starbase Studios down in Oklahoma City said that if you've got a fan film, you can go down and shoot there for free.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got a bridge.
Yep.
I've been on it. It's cool. It is cool. I sat there and I think, if only I had a script. You know? Because, yep. I mean, last I checked, I think they were close to finishing the transporter room. They've got at least one diagnostic bag for a corner of sick bay. So, mm-hmm. you know, they're expanding their building. But, you know, you get some serious momentum behind these things. I mean, Star Trek Continues actually got to use the real Galileo shuttlecraft prop
mm-hmm.
from the TV show. It's down in Houston now at Johnson Space Center. They used it for a couple of shots in their... one of those episodes. I don't even remember mm-hmm. which one, but you know, that's fan film that's got some weight to it.
Sure.
And I don't know. It just, for a while with the Star Wars films, the fan films, there were some question because Lucasfilm hadn't gotten behind it.
Right.
Until they did the fan film awards, the fan film competition mm-hmm. with Spike, I guess, the Spike Network. And that's actually coming back,
competition.
We haven't heard a whole lot about it yet.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, now it's, you know, it, since Disney bought Lucasfilm, mm-hmm. there's been more of the acknowledgement of just how much the fan base has made all of this possible. And they're going to do the fan film awards again for the first time in, I think, 3 or 4 or 5 years.
Right.
So that'll be something to look forward to. We'll see what people come up with there. But that's actually even more international than Star Trek,
right,
as far as the fan films go. But yeah, I gotta wonder about this that Roddenberry is saying here, that the next big thing is going to come from a fan out here somewhere. Maybe somebody that's listening to our show is going to come up with the next big idea.
Well, it doesn't surprise me because fans are a legitimate force. You know, fans bring back shows that are canceled. Fans support shows when they're off the air. They would never have brought back Doctor Who or Star Wars or Star Trek or any of these things if there had not been fans wanting them.
Yeah.
And there had not been a sizable number of fans calling for it. You know, wondering what they had to do to get, you know, new episodes of Doctor Who or another Star Wars movie that didn't involve, you know, midichlorians and
midi what?
Nothing. Just strange. You know, it's one of those Star Wars words. It doesn't mean anything.
Didn't see anything.
Okay. And so, you know, but also, generally speaking, and you know, though this is the kind of sweeping statement that always gets you in trouble. Generally speaking, science fiction and fantasy fans are pretty darn intelligent.
Yeah,
I mean,
for the most part.
And at the risk of painting non-genre fans as less intelligent, which I'm not trying to do, there's a lot of brain power in the science fiction and fantasy fan base.
Yeah.
And they're creative. And yes, you can find creative and intelligent people in every you know audience out there. But I don't think they're.
You're not going to find. Well, maybe you will. I don't know. I haven't been really paying attention to it. I mean, certainly on you know things like Twilight, but Twilight's genre,
mm-hmm.
and from that we get 50 Shades of Grey. Which, right. You know, I mean, it's fan fiction. It's
right.
Twilight fan fiction.
Right.
So I guess it counts in the genre, but you don't see very much.
It started as Twilight. Yeah, because it definitely did
it
not
still
end that way.
But it's one of those things where outside of the genre,
mm-hmm.
outside of science fiction, fantasy, horror, I don't know that we see a whole lot of fan fiction to the degree that we do with Star Trek, Star Wars.
Ooh, actually, maybe not in the same level, but you know, certainly you can argue that Sherlock Holmes is his.
Yeah, but it could be argued that Sherlock Holmes is kind of sort of genre.
Well, some
people make the case.
Sherlock Holmes is an interesting thing. Actually, on my way over here tonight, because we are recording this in the evening.
Yes.
And on my way over, the Canadian show Q,
mm-hmm.
the radio show. They had a guy on who has just written a book about Sherlock Holmes and his appeal and the various versions of the characters and what people like about him.
Right.
And why the character is so popular. And
it's because he's an alien.
Yes. That's exactly what it is. How did you know? No, it's because in some respects, for all the fact that Holmes is well, you could argue that Holmes was actually the first superhero, and his superpower is his mind.
I could see that.
But his mind is a normal; it's a human mind that has been trained. So you could
like Batman.
Yeah, you could. But see, the thing is, you could train your own mind to do that. You know, if he can do that, maybe I can. You know, and that's an appeal. Is that it's his power is not out of reach.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's an, you know, just if you choose to do that, if that's what you want to, you know, if that's the direction you want to take, then you could do it maybe. And it's opened the character up to a lot of interpretation. In fact, I'd say that in terms of in terms of genre character or a single character, Holmes probably beats just about everybody for radical reinterpretations of the character since he was created. Elementary, you know, Sherlock, the Guy Ritchie movies, Basil Rathbone, Jeremy Brett, Christopher Lee, Peter Cushing,
young Sherlock Holmes,
Sherlock Holmes' smarter brother.
Ian McKellen,
the Mr. Holmes, yes, the private life of Sherlock Holmes. You can run with this character in a lot of different directions, and you don't quite get the same kind of reaction if you do like a radical reinterpretation of Holmes. That you would say it's like, and now Batman's costume will be pink.
Yeah,
fans would go ballistic. But if you sit there and do a female version of Sherlock Holmes and still call it Sherlock Holmes, but just have a woman play the part, you could probably get away with it. Elementary did it with Watson.
Yeah.
And to be perfectly honest, I love the show. And Lucy Liu can be Watson for as long as she wants. She's doing a fine job because the characters allow that kind of interpretation. You can transplant Holmes into the future. Or the past, or the present, without the same kind of, you know, it's one of those characters.
Where did I find it?
You know, DC did it with Elseworlds. You know, Marvel did it with What If.
George Mann has a series of books, Newbery and Hobbes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically Sir Maurice Newbery and his unflappable assistant, Miss Veronica Hobbes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically a steampunk Holmes and Watson.
Sure, there's a
there's a whole series. I think he's got three or four of these. But Veronica Hobbes is essentially Watson.
Sure. Well, and they did the Solar Ponds Mysteries, which was a pastiche of Holmes. And there have been a number of different. Actually, I think the first female Watson was the cartoon. There was the Sherlock Holmes in the future cartoon.
Right.
And Watson was a beat cop or a detective or something like that. I don't remember the show. It was pretty terrible. But
you're remembering more about it than I did.
Yeah, well, it's... but there's been a couple of different... there was a comic book set in the Sigil universe.
Disney made one where he was a mouse.
Right, exactly. So you could argue. Well, and then you look at there have been several different anthologies where writers who are fans have published you know, short stories or certainly, you know, well, let's face it. There's so many books about, you know, telling new Holmes stories from, they're essentially fan fiction. They're licensed fan fiction because they're licensed by the estate or they're licensed by the publisher or whatever. Yeah.
You know, I wonder if Lucasfilm is going to get back into the fan film awards. Mm-hmm. I wonder if they would ever consider something like Strange New Worlds, where you do a fan fiction anthology that's not part of the canon.
Well,
because you have the story group and everything, but as a, you know, that's the minor leagues.
Mm-hmm.
It's where you find the new raw talent. I wonder if they would ever consider doing something like that.
Oh, I think it's a possibility. I think that you are going to run into, right now, maybe a little more the question of don't tread on the as we build the official new official Star Wars universe.
Right.
You know, we're not going to let you tread on anything that we don't want you treading on.
I think it's funny, though, that Star Wars Rebels is probably the most accurate, the most well-put-together, licensed fan fiction out there right now.
Mm-hmm.
Because you watch the second season premiere, Assault on Lothal, and you've got Ahsoka Tano is back, and you know Darth Vader figures into the story quite a bit, and
sure,
you know, Lando's in that, and all of this, and you think, man, because the story beats and the musical cues and everything's in there.
Mm-hmm.
And it really does feel like Star Wars.
Right.
Like there are fans, there are true fans doing this show.
Oh, sure.
And it really does feel like if it was fan fiction,
mm-hmm.
this would be the stuff that everybody would be looking at is why isn't Lucasfilm doing this stuff?
Right.
You know, that's the level it's at as far as being fan produced.
Mm-hmm.
But I think also you've got, you know, whatever else is out there that's made by fans, there's an opportunity there for the real license holders to be looking at some of this stuff and saying, you know, we like what you did over there. Why don't you come do it for us? Well, it's the guys that build the droids.
Oh, yeah, sure.
In London.
Uh-huh.
And they got hired to actually build R2-D2 for the movies.
Well, or the fans who build credit sequences for Doctor Who.
Right, yes.
So, you know, Stephen Moffat calls him up and says, can we use that? And the guy, you know, after he finishes squeeing... he says, yeah, you can. I think they certainly do pay attention. I think maybe
we need to get on that Star Wars fan film then.
Well, it wouldn't necessarily be a bad idea. I'm glad they're out there doing it. I'm glad the fans are out there telling new stories in those universes. I think it's always interesting to find the ones that are really, really good.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of wish that YouTube hath its uses, but there's a lot of dreck.
Oh,
and,
yes.
And in 100% support of all fans telling news stories, some of them are better than others.
Yeah.
And some of them, it's just like, oh, no, don't post that. Don't post that. Take that down.
And the other thing, the other aspect of it, too, is, you know, with us being a news journal with mm-hmm. us, you know, focusing on news of the genre. One thing that we have not done a lot of is news about fan productions.
That's true. We have.
And I've gone back and forth debating about whether or not we should cover fan operations to a greater extent.
Sure.
I'm wondering if we should. I mean, I don't. If you guys out there who are listening, you tell us. You know, send us an email. Let us know. h2o@scififorme.com. Tell us. Do you want us? Would it be appropriate? I think there are days I think it'd be fine. There are days I sit there and think, well, I don't know, because you know you get into that whole gray area. If we focus too much attention on something, is it going to backfire? Because, well, it's like, you know, it's like we get right here with Alec Peters over at Axanar.
Mm-hmm.
He says, these stories are going around the web and nobody's asking me about it.
Oh, sure.
You know, you get all of this. And so, you know, there is a responsibility from a journalism standpoint
mm-hmm.
to, you know, be in contact with these people. But then, you know, does this count as news in the genre, or are these just, you know, these are just fans and okay, that's fine, you know, pat them on the head and they go and do their own thing?
Well, you know, I think that if you're doing something like Star Trek Continues or New Voyages or any of these folks that are, you know, making a concerted effort to tell continuation
right.
of a series.
I mean, because we covered Renegades.
Yeah. Because that's a commitment. That's something they're not just, you know, one off and done. You know, they're basically, and they've been around for a while.
Mm-hmm.
These are not things that have just, you know, popped up. They've been around for, gosh, when did some of those start?
Oh, New Voyages has been going on for what, 10 years?
Yeah. So, and I think it's a legitimate area that something could be a story, you know, certainly a news story could be written, and certainly reviews could be done as well.
Yeah.
Because I think that reviewing this sort of thing may actually be part and parcel of the same thing that we do for reviewing other things, because just because something is done in a universe that you love, you've got something new, someone's created something, doesn't mean it's any good.
Mm-hmm.
Again, go to YouTube, type in fill in the blank fan film,
anything, yeah,
and sit there and go, no, don't ever do that again. I just saw some Spider-Man fan film not too long ago, and I'm like, oh, wow. Okay, well, you know, good for you. You went out and did it. I mean, yeah. You know, you got to, you wanted to tell your story, and you did, and that's great. I hope the next one will be better. And, you know, but I also remember making the first film that I ever made.
Which nobody will ever see.
Which nobody will ever see. it's a feature, and nobody's ever going to see it.
And I've got so many different things that I need to work on. You're just from a story standpoint, I've got books to write and scripts to write, and I don't have all the time in the world. You know, that's supposed to get easier as you get older, right? The time management thing.
Oh, sure. You're
supposed to have that figured out by now.
No, well, the older you get, the more you realize you can't.
Oh yeah, okay, time, that's
that,
it.
That whole management thing is kind of a. Well, you can try.
Yeah. Well, speaking of time management, we're about at the end of our hour. So we're going to cut it off here. But we do want to hear from you. Mm-hmm. Let us know if you're interested in us covering more fan productions or not. You can tell us either way. Mm-hmm. H2O@scififorme.com or call our hotline 573-42-SCIFI. I was about to say 573-42 hotline. That wouldn't work. Every week there's always something. You can join us on social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Pinterest, Google+, YouTube, and Tumblr. And leave us a comment on one of those channels. Facebook would probably be your quickest way to do it. And then find us over at scififorme.com where you can leave comments on the articles there as well. That's going to do it for us this week. Next week we will be talking about something else completely different from this week.
I imagine it will involve fans in some way.
It may. It may just do that.
Because we're fans too.
Yes. All right. That's going to do it for us. Jason Hunt here. Timothy Harvey.
Always a pleasure.
And we will be back with another episode of H2O next week.
This has been a presentation of SciFiForMe.com. Copyright 2015 by Flaming Dog Media, LLC. All rights reserved. No portion of this program may be retransmitted without the express written consent of Flaming Dog Media. This is SciFiForMe Radio.